you win Punjab, you will win the national election. And yet these two parties both have their stronghold in Punjab.
Election time in Pakistan has many complicated facets. It's Wednesday, July 25th. This is VOA Asia. Hello, I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. You'll find us as well on Facebook at VOA Asia. Coming up, China woos Sri Lanka but downplays significance. Engineering affordable filters. Turbulence in Chinese business sectors. Gene editing gone bad. And sipping the fog. It's all on today's VOA Asia. Pakistan's military fanned out across the country ahead of today's election, deploying hundreds of thousands of troops to oversee polling stations in a contest that analysts say is still up for grabs. The military has stationed over 370,000 personnel nationwide to ensure the vote goes smoothly, the largest such deployment in Pakistan's history on an election day. An additional 450,000 police have also been assigned to provide security, according to election officials. The military presence is just the latest controversy in a bitter campaign season that has seen accusations of pre-poll rigging, the expansion of hardline religious parties, and a string of bloody militant attacks that have killed more than 180 people, including three candidates. The contest has largely been distilled to a two-party fight between jailed former Prime Minister Nawaz Sharif's incumbent Pakistan Muslim League Nawaz Party and cricket legend Imran Khan's Pakistan Tehreek-e-Insaf. Michael Kugelman is the Deputy Director of the Asia Program and Senior Associate for South Asia at the Wilson Center here in Washington. He spoke with VOA Asia's Ira Melman about the election.
Michael, you wrote earlier this week that a big storyline in the lead-up to the election has been the nature of the relationship between Imran Khan, the cricket star-turned-politician, and the leader of the PTI, or Pakistan Tehreek-e-Insaf Party, and the country's powerful military. But you also write there that given Khan's personality and policy positions, there's reason to doubt that he is the army's blue-eyed boy. Why?
Yeah, so it's really complicated. There certainly is a pretty strong narrative that's been pushed by the incumbent party, the PMLN party, the rival of the PTI, as well as a number of observers in and out, inside and outside of Pakistan, that you know, the military essentially is trying to engineer certain actions behind the scenes to make it easier for the PTI to sweep to victory, and that the military would much prefer to have a PTI-led government with Imran Khan as prime minister. But what I argue is that absolutely, I think the military certainly has an incentive for the incumbent PMLN party not to return to power, because the military and the PMLN disagreed and sparred a whole lot over the last few years. However, it may be a bit questionable to suggest that the army would actually want Imran Khan to be prime minister. And I say that because the military in Pakistan is the most powerful player in the country's politics. What it really hopes to have in any type of government, not just the one that'll take office after this election, but any time, it wants to have a weak, fractious government that is easy to influence and exploit. For the army in Pakistan, having someone like Imran Khan running the show, who is very self-assured, very confident, very strong-willed, very stubborn, not prone to deferring to authority, I think that would really worry the Pakistani military. Now, of course, Imran Khan has never held power before. He's always been someone there in the opposition. If he were to suddenly become prime minister, maybe he would moderate his act, his personality would evolve, his political personality would evolve, and he would indeed defer to the Pakistani military, which many civilian leaders in Pakistan do, in order not to get pushed out of power. But I do think that looking at things now, you know, Imran Khan may not be a comfortable choice for the army, simply because he's a wild card. He's hard to predict. He can even be somewhat erratic at times. These are not the types of qualities the army looks for in Pakistan for its preferred civilian leaders.
For those who have not kept up on the Pakistan election, where does it stand? It is between Khan and who has the better qualifications? Who do you think might win this election?
So it really comes down to two parties. One is the incumbent Pakistan Muslim League Nawaz, PMLN, and the PTI party led by Imran Khan. the PMLN, its prime minister candidate is Shahbaz Sharif, who is the brother of Nawaz Sharif, who had been prime minister under the recent, the past Pakistani government until he was disqualified from power on corruption charges last year and then sentenced to 10 years in prison earlier this month, which is where he now is in prison. And it's interesting because, you know, I say that Imran Khan is mercurial, hard to predict. Shahbaz Sharif is the opposite. He's actually got a reputation for being very level-headed, a good bureaucrat. He may not have charisma like Imran Khan does, but he is someone that's seen as pliable, someone that the army would like. In terms of who the favorite is, it's a close race. It's very close to call, and that's because both of these parties are really neck and neck, and particularly in the province of Punjab, which is the largest province in Pakistan, and it's also the province that has the most seats in parliament. So basically, if you win Punjab, you will win the national election. And yet, these two parties both have their stronghold in Punjab. So, you know, recent surveys and polls show that it's a pretty close race. The PMLN tends to have a close advantage, but it's very close. So I think that what's most likely, the most likely outcome is, a hung parliament, which basically means no one party wins an absolute majority, and that the party that does win the most votes needs to essentially form a power-sharing agreement and govern in a coalition. I think that's what we're most likely to see. If I had to put money on it, I would say that the PMLN would eke out a narrow victory, but it could certainly go the other way, too.
Michael Kugelman is the Deputy Director of the Asia Program and Senior Associate for South Asia at the Wilson Center here in Washington. Michael, thanks once again. Perhaps we can speak after the results of the election come in.
Absolutely. We'd be happy to do so.
These are among some of the top Asia stories that you'll find currently trending on voanews.com. Monitoring group says North Korea dismantling key parts of launch site. North Korea nuclear war scenario plays out in a new book. Hundreds missing after catastrophic dam collapse in Laos. South Korea considers withdrawing some forces from demilitarized zone. Bikes out, trees in, Hanoi tackles air pollution woes. You'll find expanded coverage of these stories and more on Facebook at VOA Asia. And as always, stop by our voanews.com website. VOA Asia continues. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. China has sought to downplay its growing presence in Sri Lanka, with the state-run Global Times insisting there is no secret agreement with a new prime minister, but it's only strengthening its economic cooperation with the South Asian island nation as part of its Belt and Road Initiative. On Saturday, the prime minister said President Xi Jinping offered him nearly $300 million for any project he wished. Grant Newsham, senior research fellow at the Tokyo-based Japan Forum for Strategic Studies, tells VOA's Victor Beatty Sri Lanka is strategically located right on India's doorstep.
The Indians are, of course, not at all happy about this. Sri Lanka is definitely a place China wants to have military access, ideally a base, but even just access will do. Having gotten a 99-year lease on a very strategic port that the Chinese built and lent money to the Sri Lankans that they couldn't repay, China's in a pretty good position for right now, especially now that the new president seems to be attracted to Chinese money just like the other one was.
How strategic is Sri Lanka to China?
Well, it's extremely important to China. Particularly, it gives them the opportunity to establish a serious military presence in the Indian Ocean. China, with a port or military facility in Sri Lanka, is right off the Indian coast, and it presents a challenge from India's southern front. As you know, the Indians and the Chinese are at loggerheads up on their northern borders, and now you've got a maritime threat down on India's southern flank. So this is a big problem for the Indians. But also for China, Sri Lanka gives them a sort of a way station on the way to the Persian Gulf, to the Middle East, and onwards to Europe. You really can't really overstate the potential strategic importance of Sri Lanka. It was very important to the British as well. So these new colonialists, the Chinese, they recognize the usefulness of Sri Lanka just as well as anybody.
China's become heavily involved in local Sri Lankan politics as well.
And it's something they do everywhere. You see it in Africa, Latin America, the South Pacific. You see it in Micronesia. And it's really a pretty standard approach. Is Chinese money comes in, Chinese businesses, and this is attractive to governments and people who really could need some economic wherewithal. But unfortunately, the Chinese money comes with strings, and it's best looked at really as a form of loan sharking, ultimately. The Chinese do not give many grants. They lend money that people cannot repay, and then when they can't repay, they seize something in exchange, as they've done in Sri Lanka, as they've done elsewhere. And also, nobody talks much about it, but there's a huge under-the-table aspect to this, where local leaders, local officials are regularly bribed. Recall one case in Africa, this was about even 10 years ago, where the president of the country, according to very reliable U.S. government officials, would send a bagman up to Switzerland once a month with all the money he was getting from China. So while they do build some nice stadiums and roads, they also do pay pay under the table to get their way. And this does have a corrupting effect.
The Times of India sees the growing Chinese presence in Sri Lanka as a setback for New Delhi, with the control of its port part of a string of pearls beginning in the Straits of Malacca and dotting the Indian Ocean, circling the Indian coastline. Happening now in Asia, a jailed Reuters reporter told a court in Myanmar Monday that documents he is accused of breaking state secrets laws to obtain were planted by a police officer who handed him papers he had not sought in order to entrap him. He said the officer then lied to the court about what happened. Stay up to date with VOA. You're listening to VOA Asia. We're always glad to have you with us on VOA Asia. Thanks for listening. Access to clean and drinkable water is challenging for residents in Lahore because the tap water in many parts of the Pakistani city is polluted. A team of engineering students is working hard to create an affordable filtration system so every home can have safe water. VOA Salman Khan visited their lab and filed this report, narrated by Miguel Amaya.
Experts say that Pakistan will face severe water shortages by the year 2025. Those who live in Lahore are already experiencing the sum of its effects. Water supply problems are common in big cities like Lahore, where pollution in some areas forces people to go to water filtration plants.
Sometimes I go 4 or 5 kilometers away from home for filtered water in hopes that I can find an open filtered water pump.
Ali Manan Tirmizi is studying electrical engineering in Lahore University of Management Sciences. With the help of his team, Tirmizi is working on creating an inexpensive filtration device anyone can use at home.
We have made a very low-cost and effective filter, which is very easy to use. The current system we are working on removes bacteria very well, and we are also trying to make it able to block viruses in the water as well.
Many poor neighborhoods are not reached by safe water supplies, so we're working on a decentralized system that anyone can use to make the water at home drinkable.
Pine tree branches are used in the filter unit.
We need decent-sized branches that have enough xylem vessel bundles. We cut that into 2 to 3 centimeter pieces and place it in a boiling water with a chemical overnight. This becomes the base of our filter, and we continue working from there.
As the water shortage problem gets more severe in Pakistan, this student-developed filter will become more important. For Salman Khan in Lahore, Pakistan, this is Miguel Amaya, VOA News.
Coming up, China deals with a vaccine scandal. You're listening to VOA Asia.
Your requests, your dedications, and interviews and performances by your favorite music superstars. It's Border Crossings. This is Larry London. Be sure to tune in every Monday through Friday at 15 hours Universal Time on VOA or online at voanews.com. You've got control. Border Crossings, weekdays at 15 hours Universal Time at voanews.com and the Voice of America.
this news from VOA Asia, two former U.S. ambassadors to South Korea say they're confident that the security alliance between Washington and Seoul will remain in place and even grow stronger if North Korea fulfills its promises to end its nuclear programs and reduce tensions with the South. Always in place is VOA Asia Facebook, a great source for the day's latest news. This is VOA Asia. As VOA Asia continues, troubles for vaccines and soybeans in China are explained by Skylar Ogden in this week's VOA Asia Business Scene.
China's drug industry is in trouble as yet another scandal hits it. This time, the scandal involves a rabies vaccine made by one of the country's biggest pharmaceutical companies, Changzhou Changxian Biotechnology. Regulators halted production of the rabies vaccine made by the company after finding fabricated records and other problems during an inspection. The news sent stocks tumbling. Shares of Changzhou Changxian's parent company fell by the 10% limit. Other drug companies were also affected. Vaccine suppliers Shenzhen Kangtai Biological Products and Walvax Biotechnology also dropped by its 10% daily allowable limit. This is the third crisis involving vaccines since 2010. Most recently, regulators found diphtheria, tetanus, and pertussis vaccines made by Changzhou Changxian were substandard. Authorities in Hebei also accused another firm, Wuhan Institute of Biological Products, of making those same ineffective vaccines. The scandals have created a crisis of confidence in an industry which made more than $3 billion in revenue last year. Many parents say they simply won't buy Chinese-made vaccines anymore because they don't trust officials to clean up the industry. Chinese Premier Li Keqiang has vowed stern action over the latest safety scare. Soybean importers in China are quickly adapting to the new tariffs on U.S. soybeans, looking for alternative markets and switching to other substitutes whenever possible. At Hopeful Grain and Oil Group, one of China's leading agricultural companies, U.S. soybeans used to be a mainstay, but farmers switched to Brazilian soybeans just weeks before July 6th. That's the date the U.S. levied tariffs on $34 billion worth of Chinese imports, sparking immediate retaliation from Beijing. In China's central province of Hunan, farmers are reducing their use of soybean pulp meal, which is typically used as a main ingredient in animal feed. Analysts say they don't see a lot of damage being caused by the tariff war in the short run, but the long term could look differently for China. Xu Bin is a professor of economics and finance at the China Europe International Business School.
In the short run, I think the negative effects are in a sense, limited. But I worry more about the long term because now all countries are integrated. And so if you just damage the integration, then that is going to be long-lasting because if factories shift out of China to other countries, then it is difficult to shift back.
The U.S. relies heavily on the Chinese market for soybean sales. Last year, 31% of U.S. soybean production was exported to China. For VOA's Business Scene, I'm Skylar Ogden.
This news from VOA Asia. A dam collapse in Laos has left hundreds missing, thousands homeless, with at least several feared dead, according to state media and observers. Just hours before the disaster late Monday, the consortium building the project warned of a possible catastrophic failure. This story and more can be found on VOA Asia Facebook. This is VOA Asia. Now on VOA Asia, scientists studying the effects of the potentially game-changing gene editing tool CRISPR have found it can cause unexpected genetic damage that could lead to dangerous changes in some cells. VOA's Faith Lapidus has more on the development.
Scientists studying the gene editing tool CRISPR-Cas9 have found a problem. The technology, which promises to revolutionize the way we treat certain diseases, such as HIV and cancer, may not be as benign as previously thought. The technique uses ribonucleic acid molecules to guide the Cas9 protein to a defective part of a genome, where it acts like molecular scissors, cutting out a specific part of the DNA, replacing it with a corrective segment. But Alan Bradley at Britain's Wellcome Sanger Institute says it may also inadvertently lead to DNA mutations far from the repaired site.
If you're going to use this in a clinical context where you're editing billions and billions of cells in a human, then the chances are that hundreds of millions of those cells will suffer a type of damage that you didn't know before. And the potential of those cells to then become cancerous or to have some other problem is probably quite significant.
The researchers warned that some of the mutations seen in their study were too far from the target site to be picked up with standard analysis and testing methods.
This is very much a point of you find what you look for, you don't find what you don't look for. So far, the assays have really focused on a few hundred base pairs of the DNA around the target site, so where the cut is taking place. But it ignores the 3 billion bases of the rest of the genome.
Bradley says knowing where to look for these changes can make scientists more secure in their assessment of the safety of CRISPR technology and could spark renewed interest in developing other alternatives for gene editing. I'm Faith Lapidus, VOA News.
Two-thirds of the world's population currently lives with water shortages at least part of the year, according to one estimate. And climate change and growing populations are expected to stretch water supplies even further. VOA's Steve Barragona tells us experts are looking for new ways to capture this precious resource. In some places, they're harvesting water from fog.
Rain is rare in Choapa Province, Chile, just south of the Atacama Desert. Just 50 millimeters fall per year on average. What they do get here is fog. With the decade-long drought straining the already limited water supply, these fog catchers are a salvation, says agricultural engineer Pedro Hernandez.
There are communities that don't have water availability, so the fog catcher allows them to have what they didn't have before for specific agricultural activities, etc.
As the fog drifts over the hills, these mesh nets capture droplets of water, which drip into a collector. They provide enough water to sustain a new olive grove. It has been a lifeline for farmer Ricardo Alvarez.
I think this is something beautiful that we were waiting for, because before we lived from goat livestock. They have been bad years, so the livestock doesn't give enough to live. The sons are migrating to the city for work, so we were looking to have an opportunity with olives, and this project appeared, and we have to go with it.
Alvarez says the olives provide a future for the next generation and could save his community. Scientists say these fog harvesters could work better. Most are made of mesh netting, says Virginia Tech engineer Jonathan Borico.
The problem with that is if the netting is too big, the droplets sail right through the holes, and if the netting is too small, the water gets clogged in the holes. So either way you lose, you're kind of stuck between a rock and a hard place.
Borico and colleagues have developed what they call a fog harp. It has no horizontal wires, nothing to get in the way as gravity pulls water droplets down. It captures 3 times more water than a mesh net. Another way to make the mesh work better? Zap it with electricity, says Massachusetts Institute of Technology engineer Kripa Varanasi.
The electrical force then fundamentally changes the way droplets move. Instead of following the wind streamlines, they now follow electrical field lines, and a much larger percentage of these droplets now gets captured.
When the current switches on, hardly any mist can get past the electrified mesh. Varanasi's main goal is to collect mist from power plant cooling towers. But in cities like Cape Town, South Africa, where water is literally running out, he says the technology is far cheaper than other options like desalination. Steve Barragona, VOA News.
You've been listening to VOA Asia. You'll find us streaming online every day at VOA Asia Facebook and our website, voanews.com. And speaking of Facebook, if you happen to be in Myanmar, catch us on the VOA Burmese Facebook page. We stream live every day there, too. And we thank everyone who is listening to our program today in Myanmar. We also thank our director, Tracy Carter, and engineer, Kelvin Fowler, managing editor, Diane Gao, and our VOA Asia team. It includes Skylar Ogden, Ira Melman, and Doug Bernard. I'm Jim Stevenson. We're in Washington. We hope you have a super day.